for having me here. Originally I wanted to talk about computational complexity of the landscape. The work I did with Mike Douglas, paper which will be out tomorrow, but he's going to talk about it when he's here. So I'll stick to the more serious side of the work. Right, so it's a very long title. We bring ground states, multi-centric black holes, Donaldson, Donald's problems, Whedon correspondence, and the Autoreivs-Strominger of Buffer conjecture. The shorter version of the title could have been to paraphrase Hawking's famous paper of the mid-80s, why the cosmological constant is probably zero, could have been why the OSP conjecture is probably right. Now, of course, we have to keep in mind that briefly after Hawking published his paper, Duff put out another paper with the title, Why the Cosmological Constant is Probably Zero, but the proof is probably wrong. So, and of course, well, top of that, of course, now we know that the cosmological constant is not zero. So, with those caveats in mind, let's proceed. So this is work in progress with Greg Moore. Okay, the outline of my talk is, in the first part, I will talk about the D-brain four-dimensional supergravity correspondence. I'll actually elaborate quite a bit on it, because in particularly in the cases that you will eventually be interested in, the correspondence is slightly more subtle than just the usual D-brain black hole correspondence. So I'll talk at length about that. Then I'll get to the Auguri-Strominger Papa conjecture at small finite, so finite electric potential basically appearing in the problem. And then I'll actually give a general physics argument of why the conjecture is true. So in case you're not familiar with the conjecture, I unfortunately won't have much time to really review it in great detail, but it's basically a rather striking conjecture relating black hole entropy or counting of BPS black hole microstates to topological string amplitudes. So it's essentially a refinement of the usual Bekenstein-Hawking microstate counting correspondence, right? But it's something that goes far beyond leading order. In fact, it gives an infinite series of corrections to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which somehow magically are captured by topological string amplitudes, at least for these supersymmetric black holes. And so what I'll try to do is give an argument of why this indeed seems to be true.
Since you're not going to tell us or review rather the conjecture, can you say, is there really a sharp conjecture that one is trying to prove?
Well, it's a weakly lined conjecture, but in fact, these arguments will enable us to actually make it more precise. So it's actually it's asymptotic, and it was never really quite clear in which limit it's supposed to be valid. But I believe now that we can make this very precise, in which asymptotic limit is an exact equality of scenes. Right. Now it's still work in progress. So particularly in this general argument, there's a few loose ends that need to be tied up, but quite confident that we will be able to do it soon. In fact, it seems also, today there was a paper out by Strominger and his crew, which might be dual in a way to what I've learned. Okay, so. Probably the 20th time I've used this picture in a talk. Thanks, pretty. So what's the general setting? Well, it will be type 2A string theory on some Calabi-Yau manifold X, threefold, which in low energies gives rise to a four-dimensional N equals 2 supergravity theory with a number of vector multiplets. So the number equals H11, 2 over Calabi-Yau plus 1. Yeah. And in string theory, you know, we can have D6, D4, D2, D0 bound states, these sites, which then at large radius, be represented by geometric vibrates, which some gauge fluxes turn on. And those, roughly in four dimensions, give rise to BBS black holes with magnetic and electric charges. So our traditional convention for charges would be the P's would be magnetic, the Q's electric, and P naught is the sigma ray charge, PA the four ray charge, and QA is D2 and Q naught, the zero ray charge. So, well, some of the formulas will be a little bit mathematical. Well, they don't really matter that much. It's in part because I gave this talk at the math physics conference in Harvard last week. So that, but so, well, okay. So, what are the charges of a wrapped D6 grain represented by some bundle, or more generally, a sheaf? From the cloud, yeah, well, they're given by this nice formula where this term of E is just some uneconomical way of writing trace of E to DF, which is actually also valid for more general objects where you don't have a smooth F, other stuff. And this C2 is the second term class of the cloud, yeah. So in components, that means, well, P naught is just the scalar component of this differential form Q. The magnetic charges P are correspond to the two form components here. The electric charges are computed in this way. Just the DAs are, remember, basis. Didn't say it. It's an integral basis of H2 of X. And finally, Q naught is just the integral of this form of X. So in the special case of this ideal sheaf, now, okay, what is this? You can just think of this as a sort of stringy bound state of a D6 brain with D2 and D0 brain. So usually you think of these bound states as like some, you know, you take N D6 brains and then you have some non-abelian gauge fields on there, which satisfy the Donaldson in the Mathieu equation in the symmetric case. So also you get some smooth solution, and that has that D4, D2, D0 brain charges. Now, you can actually go to the single D6 brain case, which is U1 flux, and then there are no smooth ordinary instanton solution. But nevertheless, there are spinning bound states with D6 and D2 brains. Right? And so you can you have sort of singular two-dimensional objects that in the D6 brain that form a stringy bound state. And mathematically, these are just described by what is called ideal sheaves. So, and in particular, well, this special one that will be important later on, which has, as I said, magnetic D6 brain charge 1, which is taken such, which, you know, you can always arrange this, the D4 brain charge in 0. You can always arrange it by just doing, by shifting the B field if you want to do monotonous. So that's some sort of normalization if you want. And then the D2 brain charge is given by minus the class of the collection of two cycles you have in this ideal sheaf. And the D0 brain charge is minus the holomorphic roller characteristic of this two cycles and points, holomorphic oil characteristic in this case is just half the usual oil characteristic. So for a sphere, it would be you get minus 1 here, and for a GS2-ridden surface, you would get plus 1.
So the four brain charge is set to 0, and you set something. So this is a
Well, okay, the four brain charge here is set to 0. Well, so in the end, what we will want to do is count numbers of BPS states of D6, 4, 0 of these guys. And it's in fact enough to count the number of bound states for this case, and then you will know it for all BA. So why is this? Well, that's because if you have such a bound state, then the number, well, you can put it in the background, so if we start at 0 B field, Now you gradually increase the B field, so you shift one of its periods by one integral unit. And that ends you back at the same point in the moduli space, but with shifted charges. And so the D4-rate charge would have shifted, all the other charges would have shifted. But if the D6-rate charge is 1, you can always, since the D4-rate charge is integer, you can always use this procedure to put the D4-rate charge to 0, and the number of BBS states is not going to change, at least at large radius. If you shift the B field, the number of BBS states remains constant. So there's just some. This is sort of the basic thing that can generate everything else. Okay. Now, in the case of a before brain, well, there's similar formulas, and then a special case, namely a single before brain, again, single brain wrapped on some divisor given by this, with n, well, the zero brains, or more accurately, actually, it will be empty zero brains bound to it, and some U1 gauge flux terminal. Yeah. So this is sort of a string bound state, right, where the zero brains are just point-like objects, singular objects bound to the D4 brain, similar to what we had before for the D6, for the D0 system. And this, well, okay. So here, the D2 brain charge is simply given, well, it's given by the flux, and more precisely, it's the flux component in the direction of the pullback of this basis element of H2 of x integrated then over the surface. And then the zero brain charge, well, has, it's given by the number of entity zero brains plus 1/2 flux induced zero brain charge. And, this is the flux induced. And then this is actually going to be crucial in what follows. This is the curvature induced zero brain charge, right? So the order characteristic of the surface divided by 24. That's the D0 brain charge coming from the curvature of the D4 brain. And in a Clavier, this is given by this expression. So Q here refers to the triple self-intersection product of this divisor. And and the dot similarity. Okay. So now crucially, the dimension of the second cohomology of the divisor, which determines how many fluxes you can turn on, is much, much bigger than the dimension of the second cohomology of the Calabi-Yau, which is the number of D2 brain charges. So that means that the same charge can have many different flux realizations. Right. And so to the leading order for the counting entropy, this doesn't matter that much. But since we want to go way beyond that, this additional degeneracy that you get from realizing the same charges by different fluxes has to be taken into account, so this will be important. Okay, so what's the connection to black holes? Well, as usual, when G string times some measure of the charge is much less than 1, D brain description is good, and the opposite limit, the supergravity description is good. And as we all know, so one possible supergravity description of a state with charge Q is a spherically symmetric, supersymmetric black hole, which looks like this. So that's not particularly exciting, but we'll get to more exciting things perhaps further on. Anyway, the key role is played by the central charge, which we call Z. So for a given topological charge Q and complexified Kähler class, generally known by B plus IJ, J the Kähler form, this is given by this expression. So written out in components, this is just some cubic polynomial in the charges, right? Like the 6 brain charge times B plus the I plus IJ cubed over 6 and so on and so on. Plus then some instanton corrections, which become vanishingly small at large radius, at least large shape. And a regular solution, such as spherical symmetric solution, exists when this normalized central charge, this normalized by the square root of the volume, has a positive minimum in much less space. In that case, this regular black hole solution exists, and the black hole entropy solution is given by the horizon area by divided by 4, which in this particular case, thanks to the attractive mechanism, blah, 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 turns out to be equal. So it's this minimum central charge squared divided by 8 times the volume, thanks by this, of course, was this comment by a theoretical astrometer mid-90s. So this is all unknown. Now, it turns out that in some cases, actually, supersymmetric D-brain states of charge Q are actually known to exist in string theory, but nevertheless, one finds that there's no spherically symmetric black hole solution corresponds to that. So, how is that possible? And the resolution of that turned out to be that these things can be realized, always, as multi-centered black hole bound states, which looks like this. More color, more interesting. And so these are not just the usual multi-centered, equal charge black hole superpositions, if you want to get from the DPS case. They're really different charges, mutually non-local, so electric and magnetic charge, so they really form a bound state with predetermined equilibrium distances and so on. So one example of this is actually just a pure D4-brain wrapped on some divisor on some 4-cycle P, because, it's easy to see, in fact, this thing has a charge vector, of course, D4-brain charge P, but then it still has the zero-brain charge just induced from the curvature, which actually indicates that P is large, can be very very large, so it's Euler characteristic divided by 24. So that means that the central charge at B equals zero has this expression, right? So this is just the volume of the D4-brain, but then there is a minus this induced charge. Yeah. And so that means that if P is large, very ample, it's a technical condition that guarantees that all of this is positive, then you see that Z becomes zero at some large value of the given. And so from that it follows that there will be no single centered solution. If you try to construct an attractive solution, you find that you hit this regular zero, you cannot continue the solution, so it just does not exist. Nevertheless, we know, of course, that at large radius, the pure D4-brain definitely exists as a symmetric DPS thing. So, and indeed, there is a supergravity solution with those charges that corresponds to this pure D4-brain, and that is namely a two-centered bound state of a pure D6 and an empty D6-brain. How precise is actually, we take a D6, turn on some flux, S1, right, some Hondurian flux, in H2 of X, and you take empty D6, turn on some different flux, X2, and then you find that indeed, we'll give some more detail later on, that for some for suitable values of the background modulus, you do find a two-centered bound state in these charges. So let's first check that the charges indeed add up to what we expect. So first, for the general formula I gave earlier, Q is just E to the S1 minus E to the S2, which gives Q6 is 0, of course. The D4-brain charge is P, where we find P to be the difference of S1 and S2. For the D2-brain charge, you get P dot S, where S is the average of S1 and S2. And with these notations, you get for the D0-brain charge, 1 over 24, blah, blah, blah. So this you recognize as the Euler characteristic indeed of the D4-brain charge, P. Plus this thing. So this exactly is the what are the charges you get of the D4-brain wrapped on P with some additional flux F equals S terminal. So in particular, in the case that S1 plus S2 is 0, you have the pure D4-brain. So that means indeed you can realize those charges that didn't have a single-centric solution indeed with this system. So one curious subtlety that you might notice is, if um, So if P is not divisible by 2, then S1 plus S2 will also not be divisible by 2. So then this S, this induced flux, will be half integral. So you might think, well, how is that possible? But in fact, this is also, well, this corresponds to a well-known fact on curved manifolds that are not spin. It's pointed out by Fried and Witten, and also by Finasian and Moore, that indeed the flux is not just integrally quantized of these things, but then it can be a half integral shift that is proportional to the first Chern class. In this case, the first Chern class is equals at least mod 1. Before red charge itself, you get this quantization condition, which is precisely realized by this. So everything in terms of the charges all adds up nicely and corresponds exactly to what you expect for the pure deformer. Okay. Now, the right. So as I said, there will be. It's really a bound state, so you can put these things wherever you want. There will be an equilibrium distance, and that's given like in closed form by this expression where Q1 and Q2 are the charges, corresponding set of charges Z1 and Z2, evaluated at infinity. And so this section product here is the usual Dirac Schwinnert-Zwanziger electromagnetic intersection product between charges Q1 and Q2, defined in the usual way. Which also has a nice geometric expression in the case that you have 2d6 brains that correspond to sheaves C1 and 2. In that case, it's just given by the integral of the batch product of these churn characters, which A hat. Okay. So, another important thing about these solutions is that there's a stability condition, namely, of course, this equilibrium distance. To get out of this formula, has to be positive. And, we say that it is satisfied, then you see that when you approach a wall of marginal stability where the phases of these two central charges, Z1 and Z2, align, you see that this imaginary part, this product, is going to zero, and therefore R is divergent, and you see that the bound state in fact decays. Right, so this is the supergravity realization of decay at marginal stability. Right. Of course, it's well known that indeed the spectrum of VBS states is in general moduli independent. And mathematics this corresponds to the fact that all kinds of stability criteria on geometric objects that indeed boil down to exactly conditions similar to this. Okay. Finally, another interesting thing about these solutions is that they have spin. So, as some know, they're spherically symmetric BPS solutions to the gravity cannot have any spin. Maybe spin 1/2 or a bit more. However, these solutions, actually, despite the fact that they're stationary, have spin stored in there. Electromagnetic field due to the fact that you have electric and magnetic charges. The usual thing. And the spin is in fact given just by 1/2 of this section product as for the usual electromonopole system. Okay, so now, so this is all, I mean, work I did many years ago. Let's apply this now to the case of interest to us, namely to the D6 bar system. Yeah. So the intersection product in that case is, according to the formula that I gave earlier, right? This thing here, applied to this case, well, these Chern characters are just e to the S1, e to the minus S2, a hat is just this curvature correction of the Calabi-Yau. Working this out simply gives this result. And, well, for one of the thirds among you, you might recognize this number here is that as well in the case that P is again very ample divisor, this is dimension of holomorphic sections of the corresponding line model. So this is just number of deformations of the divisor of the surface inside the Calabi-Yau plus 1. And as you will see, that's no coincidence, that's what you get. stability condition in this case, this, when Taylor form goes to infinity, this boils down to this expression, and indeed indicates that P is a very young multiplier, which means just some divisor with yeah, very ample, sorry, I didn't explain that. It's just a surface that is such that every holomorphic curve has positive intersection with it. So, okay, so all this is automatically satisfied, which is good because, of course, we know that the D4 ring at large volume should exist, at least on these divisors. But then you see, well, so somehow, as I pointed out before, well, we know that the central charge becomes zero at some regular point in the moduli space. Right? Now, it just cannot be that there is a BPS state that still exists at that point in the moduli space, because then you would have a masked BPS state there that would create a singularity in the moduli space with my assumption, which is a regular point. So it must have decayed by then. And indeed, that can be verified. So if you take a path, J equals something proportional to P and P equal to S, and just follow it down, you find that indeed you cross a line or wall of marginal stability at some particular final value of R, where indeed this D4 ring will decay. Okay, and so the picture you get for the stability region is following, so it's stable, so this is sort of a caricature of the upper half plane. The one modulus k is J. So it's stable everywhere here. It doesn't exist here. Zero central charges here. And along this thing, just added for more people who are familiar with the split flow attractive picture, or this would be the split flow corresponding to state. For people who are not familiar with this, it doesn't occur. But so this structure is not visible, of course, in the classical geometric picture of a D4 ring as a holomorphic cycle. But nevertheless, it's certainly there in string theory. Okay. So, well, yeah. So as I said, nevertheless, it's certainly there in string theory. So the question is, how can you see it then microscopic, right? So because thus far, I've argued in the supergravity, this thing decays, and it's therefore, rational to ask, how do you describe this microscopic? Now, very simple, actually. In this case, it just described by a U1 times U1 quiver quantum mechanics with k given by this intersection product that we computed earlier, chi on multiplus, so k arrows, pi I. And there's no further matter because these six rays were purely six rays just shifted by some thermals of fluxes. But, you know, they don't have any intrinsic moduli of their own, so they don't have any. There's no additional light scale that's corresponding to that. So this quiver is really just this, and as we, so at least this is on a general caviar, so these six there will be some additional module height. Not in the full caviar case. So the moduli space of supersymmetric configuration of this quiver are, as you know, just given by the flatness conditions, and, well, so simplest possible case, you find that this is given by all the phi satisfying this constraint, modulo, of course, the gauge U1. And this psi is, by the obvious term, you get is such, where it depends on the moduli, and it's such that psi is bigger than zero in this stable region, it's less than zero in the unstable region. So that's how you see the disappearance of the BPS states microscopically. Moreover, you see that the moduli space here is just a symplectic quotient description of P k minus 1. Okay. And so note that, as I pointed out earlier, this matches with the geometric D4 ring picture. So remember, well, so for the D4 ring, we have that the moduli space is just given by the sections of the line bundle corresponding to this divisor, right? So it's just some hypersurface equation. These sections, so it's the space of all coefficients of this hypersurface equation, modulo the C star action is just overall scaling of these coefficients. So in other words, we do get a projective space, so Pk minus 1, where indeed this k is the same k escape here, because as I said earlier, this number of arrows that we have to be precisely the number of deformation moduli of this file, so that matches. Now you still might wonder, like, well, how can it be? You know, like there's this description of a deformed brain that G string equals zero, where it's really located at one point in space, and then somehow a G string larger, and it should go over to some two-center thing, and can be. But so this can actually also be shown this transition is can be shown in the quiver quantum mechanics to really be smooth, so smooth in the sense of that the wave function at G string equals zero really concentrates on this Higgs branch, but then when you increase G string a little bit, it sort of spreads out of this Coulomb branch. That's very ends up really. So that all matches. Okay, so let us get now more closer to what we
like. Back to that formula that you have for the radius. Can I see the string in that?
No, because this radius is in four-dimensional Planck units.
Yeah.
And if I wrote it in string units, then you would see the string. So this is just the four-dimensional Planck units. It's always fixed. But if you now send G string to zero, then the string length will start growing with respect to the Planck length, up to the point that actually the string length becomes much bigger than the separation between these two centers. And at that point, you do actually get a tachyon between these two constituent grains, and you get tachyon compensation, and it goes over into a single rep. That's what happens. Okay. So now, let's see how we can do some microscopic counting in both of these pictures. So let's look at the least significant bar again. So, in supergravity, of course, so usually there's the horizon entropy, but in this case, that's completely absent because of these sixes, probably not have any internal degrees of freedom, carry no entropy, so they're just particles. Basically, they're exactly just hypermultiplets, so the only degeneracy you get is you get two spin zero states and then one spin one half doublet of states from each of the D6s. But then, more interestingly, their dynamics is described by some two particle supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which is essentially equivalent to an electron in the field of a charge K magnetic monopole, right? Where the electron is bound on a sphere. So, in particular, the ground state, has electron spin down because of the interaction of the magnetic field with the spin. Right? So that's why this hypermultiple degeneracy of this particle gets lifted, and to minimize its energy, the spin is actually going in downwards, opposite to the magnetic field. Yeah. So you get two contributions from the total field. Spin one is the one in the electromagnetic field that I gave earlier, which is k over 2, and the other one minus 1 half the spin, so the total speed equals this, and therefore the degeneracy, if you quantize this, equals 2j plus 1 equals k. So this is just a lambda degeneracy of an electron on a sphere with k units of magnetic flux. Okay, now how do you see this microscopically?
Well,
so there, what you have to do is you look at the supersymmetric quantum mechanics in the moduli space, and VPS ground states are just the one-to-one correspondence with the homology classes of this moduli space. In this case, the moduli space was pk minus 1. So the degeneracy is given by the total dimension of the cohomology, which in this case equals the Euler characteristic, because it's known of cohomology. And for pk minus 1, that's just k. So that's exactly what we had before. So the gravity picture. So in the classical geometrically deformed picture, this maybe wouldn't have been immediately obvious because actually this moduli space has some singularities where the deformed brain degenerates, and you might have worried about contributions from those. But these appear to be absent. What about the spin? So let's say this multiplet on the supergravity side is organized. Spin k minus 1 over 2 multiplet. Well, that is here realized by so-called Lefschetz SU2 action on this on the cohomology of the moduli space. There, well, the z component of the spin is given by the form of degree minus the complex dimension over 2. Ladder operator is just given by multiplying with the Kähler form of the moduli space. And then you see, indeed, that in this case, cohomology organizes itself in spin k minus 1 over 2 multiples, 1 omega omega squared, and so on. Okay, so that matches as well. Good, so this is a rather trivial example. Confidence. So let's look at a slightly less trivial example, namely bound states of V6s with n, with well, the number of V0 rings. So, well, again, these can form a BBS bound state, but not at, well, if you just send the radius to infinity and keep the B field constant, then you do not get a bound state, because large radius V6 and V0 is not a bound state. However, if you take the B field sufficiently large, you do get a bound state. And this follows from the stability condition, which is given by this equation, in this case approximately, just saying that the third power of B plus ij, the imaginary part of that has to be positive, which in the complex plane looks like this. Right? So on this side of this line, right, this is a marginal stability line here, for the stable region, here an unstable region, and again, for those familiar with the split attractor flows, this would be the, so this would be the single attractor flow which hits the zero. So there's no single centered solution again, but you get a two centered solution. All right. Now we can use this picture to do the counting of these BPS states macroscopically, and it's actually a lot easier than the microscopic equation. So how does this work? Well, first of all, we should observe that the zero rings can form bound states amongst themselves of arbitrary zero ring charge. And so to, in order to have a BPS, each of these clumps has to have positive zero rate charge. That's the only constraint. Everything else is possible. Now, each of these zero particles can be, or clumps, can be in a one particle state. Well, that's given by the product of just the spatial part, which is just a half hyper multiple, as usual, times then the internal states it can get in the Calabi-Yau, which are, again, given just by the cohomology of their moduli space, which in this case just the Calabi-Yau. So these are just the one particle states that these zero rings can assume. Now we put them in this V6 magnetic field. Yeah. So then, as we had before, the first factor that's frozen because of that is just the spin down states opposite to the magnetic field. And as a consequence, you get that the even cohomology of X will correspond to the bosons. Why is that? Well, because there's so. So before you multiply by this one half down, there is even cohomology. Well, even cohomologies arrange themselves in multiplets of even lengths, so they are fermionic, and then you multiply this spin one half from the spatial part, so you get bosons the other way around for fermions. Okay, and then most crucially, particle, and this is very much harder to see microscopically. So particle of the zero rate charge M bound to this single V6 has intersection product M, and therefore, as we saw before, lambda degeneracy also equal to M. Okay, so once you have that, the rest is easy because these, well, the zero rates, because of the BBS condition, they're non-interacting at rest. So the multi-particle ground states are just given by a Fock space, free Fock space built from a creation operators corresponding to these one particle states. after they label for these internal states for this n here and then for degeneracy labels here. So taking all that together in the usual way, you get a generating function for the number of V6 and V0 BPS states counted with signs. So take the other minus one to the other. and that simply assembles itself in this function. But this M here comes from the lambda degeneracies, and the chi here comes just from the difference of the number of h even and the number of h off. And what you get, well, this function is known as the McMain function. So you get this McMain function, the minus chi of x. This can also be derived microscopically, but it took those people a long time. It's very non-trivial. Okay. In fact, it's not even mathematically established yet. So, well, to get there, this is in fact, so these D6, D0 bound states are a special case of a so-called non-symptomatic invariance. So what do they in general? Well, remember these ideal sheaves at the beginning, which are these D6, D2, D0 bound states, right? Red, well, these sort of stringy D6, D2, D0 bound states. So these are these D2 red charge, D0 red charge, you can do that. So they are believed to mathematically they're well defined, but they're believed by some just virtual class, blah, blah, whatnot, but they're believed to just count D6, D2, D0, DDS bound states in some appropriate region of the modified space. And mathematicians organize these, as we would do, in some generating function, coefficients counting these numbers. And now these people conjectured that the degree zero partition function, which corresponds to no D2 brain charge, so just pure D0 brain charge, should be given exactly by this McMain function to the minus chi of x. But so, as I said, this is mathematically speaking, this is just a conjecture, which has been verified in a number of cases. So as you see, this exactly corresponds to this microscopic counting. To the non-centered particle counting. All right, so that further strengthens our confidence in those counting methods. So finally, well, you can step it up a bit, go a step higher complexity, and look at more general configuration, so you get a D6, an anti-D6, but now you induce more stuff, so you have more entropic content to it. And around one of these D6s, you can even have another cloud of D0 brains, as we had earlier, so you have sort of double-make system if you want. And again, you can try to count BDS states in this way. And roughly, you expect that the number of microstates corresponding to the system would correspond to just the horizon entropies, just product of these two, times then some factor giving the lambda degeneracies and also these D0 degeneracies as we had before. Okay. And then the total degeneracies is obtained by summing over all possible configurations with the same net charge. So, and indeed, well, as long as the stuff you add to the D6 and the empty D6s that are there, it's not too large, total entropy will indeed still be dominated by these configurations, right? So particularly if it's the added D0 rain charge, this doesn't overpower this induced chi p over 24, then there will still be no single-centered solutions to begin with. So this would indeed give the dominant contribution. And finally, the microscopic description of these configurations. So, presumably given at least to some approximation by some, if you want quiver, but now a quiver, well, again, with k, well, with two nodes and k arrows, but the nodes themselves have now a lot of moduli because you just have added stuff to those. So, roughly, then the moduli space should be some pk minus one vibration over the product of moduli spaces for each of those. And in some approximation, you also expect indeed the number of BBS states corresponding to this moduli space to be the characteristic of pk minus 1, which is k times the product, what you get from these individual moduli spaces. Okay, so let's now apply all this to these things OSV conjecture. Okay, so so in order to do that, well, define as a Fourier system in general, I did the following partition function. So you just you fix the magnetic 54 rate charge, and you sum over the 0 and the 2 rate charges, and what you sum is this number of EBS states counted with signs times its weight, which is just basically phi naught and phi a. You can think of electric potentials multiplying the charges q naught and qa. And remember that these, well, in terms of microscopic quantities, are these expressions. Okay. Right. So let's try to do this counting. So first off, the supersymmetric conditions. So well, okay, you turn on some flux, yeah. So then typically that will actually break all supersymmetry, because in order to have a supersymmetric configuration, the flux has to be of type 1-1. So requiring this, well, in fact, can still often be realized, but only at special points in the moduli space of the Fourier. So this puts constraints, possibly even freezing completely the device array. This was also pointed out by some people here. And by Strominger at all. So, as I said earlier, also because H2 of B is much bigger than H2 of X, there are many different fluxes giving the same charges. So each sector gives a certain constrained moduli space of divided deformations, right, in this way. Doesn't multiply with the zeros counted before. So you can write this as degeneracy for Q0 and QA is the sum over all the fluxes and values of numbers of the zero grains that correspond to the same charges Q0 and QA of then the order characteristic of the corresponding reduced moduli space. That's what you would have to compute. Okay, so this is still too hard, it seems, to compute in general. But it can be evaluated at small phi naught. So if phi naught is small, then this sum is dominated by large values of q naught. And in that limit, actually, this thing can be evaluated directly. Why is that? Well, in fact, this, the idea is the same Shock and Douglas and Douglas and myself developed for counting flux factor in the landscape. Right? So that in this limit, when you allow the zero range charge to become large, which means you allow this F squared to become large, you basically are summing over very large fluxes. And that means you can essentially forget about the quantization and replace the sum over fluxes by an integral over fluxes. And then you can just apply exactly the same techniques as we did there, after a lengthy calculation that I can give here now, you can, in fact, rewrite this whole partition sum as some Gaussian boson fermion system with some Q symmetry, some topological Q symmetry, which you can see that it's really fake, you know, like it just pretends like it checks for updates, and it just pops up even in the connections. Anyway, yeah. Okay, so if you just work this all out, then you get this expression for this partition function that I gave earlier, where, well, this prefactor chi hat is the same, this analogous thing as one. Gets in this Gaussian formulas for a string flux factor. It's the integral over the moduli space of the terms of R. So this, if you want, is what we could call differential geometric order characteristic of the moduli space. which, however, is not necessarily equal to the actual electricity of the topological electricity of the fundamental space, again, because this metric is, in fact, singular. But by comparing these results to results of by Shiffrin, in fact, it indicates that, indeed, it seems to be the case. So this is also interesting, in fact, for this program of counting flux vector, where a big problem was always actually computing this final integral. But now, well, these results definitely suggest that this integral is just the most naive thing you might have thought, that this is completely forget about all these weird singularities and so on. And that is just given by the topological architectures. Anyway, this is just some prefactor thing. So encoded in this thing is if you now do some try to extract the generalities from this by computing some contour integral, then you can evaluate this thing in a subtle point approximation, and you reproduce the usual formula for black hole entropy at large radius. But as you see, it just takes you into account the classical geometry of the Calabriard interpolation. Okay, so this is the result. Now, I said that this would have something to do with the Fogarisky and Weber conjecture. Indeed, it does. So what is this OSV conjecture? Well, that simplest form says that this BPS partition function, COSV, is nothing but the norm squared, if you want, of the exponential of the topological string-free energy. Yeah. Now, the topological string-free energy depends on the topological string coupling constant and on the Kalen modulus, whereas there was no such thing on this side, right, because it was just these electric potentials. So, in order for this to make sense, you have to describe what substitutions you make on this side, and these substitutions in specific cases look like this. Indeed, you find that when you plug this in into this topological string, free energy, and you drop all the instanton corrections, which is really what defines the interesting content of a topological string, then indeed you find exactly what I wrote here. Oops. So, well, this agreement is perhaps somewhat surprising, given that, you know, in this limit final to zero, the topological string coupling effect goes to infinity, and a priori topological string series is only asymptotic in number to zero, but nevertheless, this matches. Okay, and now in the final part, which will be very brief, I'll give a general argument for. So, okay, here, you know, in this case. Okay, this matches and it's nice that it uses these landscape techniques, and you don't have to make any other assumptions. But of course, it's only at the perturbative level, and all these instanton corrections, which are the real interesting contents of the conjecture, all disappear. So you would actually want more, and so this would be a more general argument using this whole lengthy introduction about how the seven black holes that I gave earlier. For that, I will not be able to give any details of the calculations, but this is the idea. So first off, the first observation is that this ZOSV that I wrote down earlier is in fact particularly general limits of something more physical, which would be topologically twisted theory of the deforming on wrapped on some Euclidean time circle times the surface P. And, well, this thing presumably localizes us on BPS configuration, so you get just some over different flux sectors of the theory of the number of BPS states in that sector, times then just the classical action at in that sector, right? Which is just, well, circle length divided by G string times the modulus substitute value of the central charge. This is just the Born infant part of the action, and then this is the Western Meno part of the action, whatever you want to call it, right? So that's minus B appearing in case. The C2 and the C0, of course, in type 2A, you have C3 and C1, but these are just dimensional reductions of C1 and C3. Yeah. And here, this is just basically the zero range charge, the two range charge, and so on, right? So you maybe recognize this fate, it looks like what I had before, and indeed, in the limit that beta goes to zero, so this thing drops, if you take B equal to zero, so that disappears. You take C naught equal to I phi naught, and C2 to I phi equal to I phi 2, this whole thing, in fact, turns into this OSP. So if you don't believe me, here it is, right? That thing is just some degenerate limit of this more physical guy. Now, this physical guy, as you expect for a physical guy, in fact, has also much better convergence properties than the OSP thing. In fact, the OSP thing has very bad convergence. It diverges just everywhere. So this is also a good regularization. But okay, that's good to perhaps make things more rigorous in this context. But it's especially good because, you know, once we have embedded this in this more physical theory, we can also use various dualities we know that there are true in the physical theory. And so in particular, we do the following. We first t-dualize of a time, Euclidean time circle. This turns this t4 and Euclidean d3. Then we l-dualize the Euclidean d3 partition sum, and because of that duality, this, you know, will change the background fields, but it should keep the partition sum the same up to some potential modular scale factor, and then t-dualize back to the d4 grid. So that has the following effect on the background, so it should keep the partition function invariant up to some such factor, perhaps, but it has the effect of mapping C0 to minus 1 over itself, putting C2 equal to 0, putting B equal to C2, and then just some rescaling of the volume modulus. And invariance then, if you plug all these things in, means that the original OSP sum gets transformed into this guy. So here you recognize the zero brain charge, the two brain charge. Now, this is a very, very non-trivial resummation, if you want. So first off, well, yes, let's have a look. Oh yeah, this part here, this is just what is possible. It can transform as a modular form in general, and so indeed we did find in this other direct case that this W is in fact 1 minus something or 2, so that just add. But it's not very important. So as usual, we take the real part of finite less than zero, which makes this more or less convergent. Yeah. So then you see that now, in this resummed version, the leading contribution comes actually from the n equals zero, f equals zero term, right? Because in fact, on supersymmetric configurations, this n is always positive and f squared is always negative. In fact, this is not quite right because there's one bad positive mode of supersymmetric f squared, which is proportional to the Kähler form, which is actually disappears in this regularization. It can be taken care of in that way. But apart from that, that's what you find. This is also what causes this thing to diverge, which has to be recognized. But so one immediate consequence is that we get the previous result, which was done, you know, using quite a lot of analysis. We get this for free because you see the phi naught to zero limit. This whole series just collapses to the first term, so you get that this is equal to this guy plus this kind of repeat, and all that times the number of EPS states in the zero flux sector and n equals zero sector. But that is just the number of EPS states of the pure D4 brain, which is just the Euler characteristic of the moduli space. Remember, which is this pk minus 1 we've been using. So that's this chi of mp, which is precisely what we find before, provided, again, that the differential Euler characteristic is the same as the topological one. That seems to be confirmed again. So that's automatic. This probably, and so keep in mind that from this formula follows this entirely the large D0 range charge black hole entropy formula, including non-trivial corrections. So this is probably the shortest possible derivation of black hole entropy out of string theory, just from epsilon, I think. But more generally, and this is where it gets interesting, at least at large p, so when this chi of p becomes very large, yeah, that's the crucial thing. Actually, more precisely, it will be this chi of p over phi naught goes to infinity, but p of phi over phi naught can stay finite. So that's actually the limit in which the following is going to be exact. Well, and you see that this n minus f squared over 2, the zero grain charge induced by the zero grains by the flux, has to become very large before, in fact, single-centered black hole configuration can start to exist, right? So in the zero flux sector, you have this pure d4, that was d6 and d6. Now you add some fluxes and some n. But as long as, you know, see this guy of p is very large, it will take a long time before you get actually anything else than these two separate configurations in this talk. And so, to a very good approximation, you can just focus on those terms where the entropy is dominated by those guys. And in fact, this becomes exact when in the limit at the time of p over phi naught goes to infinity. So you get that these highly entropic states through this S duality get mapped to these lowest light states. So, and that you can count the entropy of these other guys basically through this transformation in terms of the degeneracies of these lowest light states. And so how do we do this? Well, it's very simple. So I will lay on the ground for it. So the BPS states of these two centers, they are counted by Donaldson Thomas invariants of these ideal sheaves, right? With this one subtlety that, well, you know, there is the zero brain, this class of the zero brains. You can either bind the zero brains to this guy or to the other guy, which one will actually depend on the B field. It's important. So you have to actually extract the degree zero part from one of the factors and not from the other. But okay, this is a technical detail. So, in particular, this zero brain cloud, in fact, gives its McMain function again, right? And the contribution that remains is what mathematicians call the reduced Donaldson Thomas. And then, well, there's a Landau degeneracy from a D6, D6 bar, which equals this. Now, this will be a little bit different once you start adding stuff to that, but again, in the limit that this over phi naught goes to infinity, these additions are vanishingly small. So you can take a Landau degeneracy for all relevant contributions to be equal to that. So then you're finally in the position to put everything together. We've got this chi of MP prefactor. Then there's this McMain function, then it's the modular weights, all that for this for, and so, well, main thing is, okay, you have to do, like, you plug in all these things and reshuffle and this and that. But the basic structure you see here, you get this one D Donaldson Thomas from one center, and you get the other one from the other center, where P and S are defined as before. And then, well, you're almost there. So now you've got this D Donaldson Thomas partition. So, okay, these are Donaldson Thomas invariants. As you know, topological strings are given by Gromov-Witten invariants, which are not quite the same. However, lucky for us, again, these guys make an interesting conjecture that, in fact, Donaldson Thomas invariants and Gromov-Witten invariants are related by simply exponentiating the Gromov-Witten thing, which is just a topological string, the incipient part of the topological string, exponentiating that, and then just relating this q we have in Zeeg-Donaldson with e to the I lambda. That's it. So applying that to our particular case just transforms this Donaldson Thomas you do the 4-pi phi naught into Gromov Witten with coupling constant 4 pi I over phi naught. And, well, this is a little bit of a mess, but it is indeed exactly the refined version of the OSV conjecture. So you might not quite see it in all this mess, but this here, together with that, is the perturbative part of the free energy after making these substitutions. These are just the instanton parts. And then you see there is this sum over S, sum over shifts. Well, that people have realized soon after the OSV conjecture came out that that had to be included in the conjecture, just because otherwise, well, this basically guarantees periodicity. So on one side of the conjecture, you have something manifest periodic, on the other side, you don't. That can be solved by adding these periods. It has to be solved like that. And you see, in this case, it comes out automatically. These are just corresponding, well, this just corresponds to the choice of different choices of flux in these six breaks. And that's it. This is exactly this OSV conjecture. OK. And so as you see, it basically just follows from S-duality and then this correspondence mathematical conjecture, which is fairly reliable. And then this last slide, well, of course, there will be corrections. So this was all, you know, approximate, but more generally, there may be more centers to consider, maybe more complicated, especially in this case, more complicated lambda degeneracies, which may interact with internal states, perhaps, even though that probably should be taken, is already taken into account when it's more complicated multi-sided. Then the most important thing, but I think we have that under control now, is actually, so I only spoke about splitting into single D6 and a single MD6. You might as well, why not in 2D6 or 3D6? I mean, like, bound states of higher rank on each side. And I believe the resolution is actually that these guys cannot form these, so the part of these bound states with the highest curvature-induced in conventions where the zero brain charge has no bound from below, can become arbitrarily negative, but not arbitrarily positive. The maximal the zero brain charge that the four brain can have is this p cubed plus c2 dot t over 24. And those are also the states that in this resummed version contribute the most. Yeah. And so I believe that when you have bound states made up more d6 brains, say of rank r, that the highest zero brain charge you can get is actually given by this p cubed over 24, but then that divided by r squared, by rank squared. I have no proof for it yet, but I think that that's the case. So again, in this limit that p cubed over phi naught goes to infinity, all of those will be killed as well, and that leaves you with this single d6, anti-d6 bound states. So this will probably, yeah. It will give corrections, but not in this particular thing. More precision, as I said, this is still a little bit work in progress. But, as I said, probably in this limit, the conjecture really becomes exact. And that's it.
So if you have more centers, is this thing going to factorize in the same way, or is it?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. So so again, in this limit, I think that is so that's not going to give more correction. But if you go away from that, yeah, well, so there's been this paper by Dek, Kopar-Kumar, Julian, Pafa, where, you know, in a non-compact case, they do look at this finites. And they call it corrections that they get in some particular Sinpo-Yang-Mills theorem. So they do get corrections that they claim they can identify with more centric solutions. I think it's slightly shaky, the arguments that they ran. In fact, so what they came up with was something that doesn't factorize anymore, so you get this difference. But now, actually, at a Harvard workshop, Hiroshi gave a talk where he said that he and students now derived a different recursion formula, where actually the thing still does factorize, but then each of the chiral factors on itself has a sum over what they call daily universe, which is not a separate solution. So instead of having the sum outside of the size of the bar, they get inside. And he says that, well, possibly the two are actually equal. But so which one would be favorite from this point of view? I don't know. I haven't so much really thought about it. It becomes complicated fairly quickly. So in fact, so this paper by also by Strominger and company today, I haven't read it yet, but as far as I understand it, well, they lifted into M theory, and then I think sort of the analogous thing of D6, anti-D6 is that they are looking at M2s and anti-M2s that are at polar opposites of a certain. So they lift their thing to alias 3 times 2 times Clavial, and so the M2 and anti-M2s are actually sitting opposite sides of the S2, and that in fact gives us a discrete configuration. So I think it's probably related, but I don't know exactly how.
But they have a similar.
They seem to confirm the conjecture a little bit too good. So it's like really exactly equal to z squared, which I don't think is the case. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's an artifact of approximations. So they don't get this factor, which I'm absolutely sure is there because it's also. Has been confirmed in different approaches, and then they also don't show this factor, which I'm also actually sure is there. So, but everything else they do. They also don't write on the sheet, as far as I know, which I'm also pretty sure. Maybe in some
approximation.
Sorry.
So we should wait for your paper.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Just for fun, is there a typo? Is one of those in the Gromov-Witten invariants, is one of those minus 2is?
No, actually that's not. So that's right. So in the original context, it's also, it's like really z bar that they have. But, and that works for everything, but it doesn't work for these shifts. So it's really a plus. On both sides, and so you can see that it has to be like that, because you see in the original definition of the partition function, you see this is manifestly periodic in the phi a's, right? Because these charges are integral. So if you send phi a to phi a plus 2i, the thing remains the same. Now, that's not true for topological string e to the f squared, because you get some polynomial, so it's definitely not periodic. But then by adding these shifts, it in fact becomes periodic, but you really need to add the same thing on both things, right? Because you really want you shift the phi, and then you want to be able to absorb this into a shift of s, but then everywhere where there's a phi, there's minus two. So that's another deviation from the original projection. Good observations.
Well, it's a great conjecture, because it seems like We're just going to keep modifying it until it's true.
Well, these are the birds that it's true.
And it's got a wheel.
Yes, but that's right. So I think, okay, that when I wrote that slide, so, well, I think so. Thank you. Don't kill me if it turns out not. It's the limit that p cubed over finite goes into infinity, and p over finite is large, but may remain finite. I think this is exactly the topic is maybe so.
No mention what the modifications I still was using in the main stage.
Right. It's remarkable. Actually, I mean, the thing is, I was one of the people writing papers saying this was probably wrong. But the thing was, we were looking at small black holes, which have p cubed equal to zero in all geometric setups. And so there, things change a lot. And in particular, there's no way to the things I dropped here are sort of deviations from having this lambda degeneracy equal to chi of NP and so on. And you can do that in this limit at p cubed over finite goes to infinity, where p over finite stays finite. But for the small black holes, you cannot take such a limit. Or you could take p over finite to infinity, but then all the instanton corrections will die as well. So you will never be able to separate. And that's indeed what we saw. So personally, it was not, it was a case that was too simple to
thank you.